Do we have the greatest Final Four of all time, plus what we learned from the Elite Eight coming up here on the College Basketball Power Hour? Welcome in to the College Basketball Power Hour. She is Ice Young. He is Jason Fitz. I am Caroline Fenton. Guys, happy Final Four. How we doing?
Amazing. Amazing. Best time of the year. Almost Christmas. Let's do it.
I think I just keep looking, and we got a lot to talk about. But guys, like, as I was sitting here watching YouTube TV split the men's and women's games over the course of the weekend and watching it, like, for all the conversation about what early tournament was lacking in Cinderella and all these things that I don't really care about, we have got to that spot where these games are just, and we're getting what we wanted, right? The best of the best. Like, as cute as Cinderella stories are, give me all number one seeds. Give me the best teams. Like, how often have we talked about there are a handful of teams in women's college basketball that are at a different echelon? Like, just the fact that we've gotten to that spot with all of those, like, I don't remember being more excited for a Final Four on the men's and women's side, because the quality of basketball across the board is just so damn good.
I've had so many people come up to me and say, are you kind of bummed that it's all 4-1 seeds on the men's side? And I keep saying, don't let the lack of Cinderella, don't let this lingering gray cloud of has NIL and transfer portal ruined college sports blind you from the fact that we have really good basketball and 4 national championship contenders on the men's side, 4 national championship contenders on the women's side, even though there's 3 1s and a 2s on the women's side. That 2, UConn, very much so as a national championship contender. It's crazy to me that we have a Cinderella in both of these tournaments that have won 11 national championships and have been to 16 of the last 17 Final Fours. Like, that's our Cinderella. The threshold for a cute, fun story in this tournament is incredibly low, and I think that's a good thing. I do want to take a deep dive into all of that, our thoughts on the Final Four, kind of our thoughts on what we saw from the Elite Eight, maybe lessons that we've learned moving forward. But before we get into all of the basketball talk and all of our takeaways, I want to touch on a piece of news that came out on Monday night. Notre Dame guard Olivia Miles will forgo the WNBA draft and will enter the transfer portal. Now, Olivia Miles was expected to be a top pick in the WNBA draft. Top 10, certainly, possibly even top 5. Olivia Miles was a key cog in this Notre Dame run. This was shocking news to me. I frankly just thought it was a foregone conclusion that Olivia Miles was headed to the W. She's not only just staying in college basketball, she's entering the transfer portal, which doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to transfer. She could stay at Notre Dame, but massive news, shocking news. Ice, help me make sense of this. Why do you think Olivia Miles made this decision?
Man, I think there are a number of reasons. You know, one, to start, she's had injuries in the past. You know, she missed a season and a half of basketball and college basketball. And so it's not surprising to me that she would decide to play more college basketball and just to get another year under her belt before going to WNBA. I think now, too, with NIL and the amount of money these athletes are making, there are different opportunities that could exist for an Olivia Miles at a different program. You know, Notre Dame, obviously a football school and has a rich history, but there are several other schools across the country that probably could pay her a bigger NIL bag, and she's one of the best players in the country. So maybe that's on the line. I'll say the hot take thing about it, because this is the first thing that I thought about, was Notre Dame this year didn't look good when Hannah Hidalgo had bad games. They couldn't win a game. If Hannah Hidalgo didn't shoot well, then Notre Dame wasn't going to win the basketball game. And I fear that in the way that Hannah Hidalgo started to take over this Notre Dame team and become kind of the star, it didn't allow Olivia Miles to be who she wanted to be. And it didn't allow them to win basketball games when it mattered. Now we can kind of look back at them losing 3 out of their last 5 games or 7 games, you count the game of the tournament, and say, oh, there were issues there. There were problems there. Not just they got that other teams were better, like there were issues. So I feel like it's a number of things. I'm honestly particularly happy because I think that Olivia Miles could use another year in college basketball before she entered the WNBA. I'm sad that it won't be with Notre Dame, because you felt like her and Neil Ivey and Hannah Hidalgo and company, you just felt like that was a family that wasn't going to be broken up. But we're in a new age. Players have choices. She should explore her options and figure out what's best for her. I certainly think, though, if you're not looking at the basketball aspect of it and saying, man, clearly she's not happy, and what's the reason being? I see it as like Notre Dame making three straight Sweet 16s, she not having, you know, maybe the season that she wanted to have. And maybe it was tough to blend her and Hannah.
Look, and if Notre Dame wants to keep her, they can put their money where their mouth is, right? Like, that's part of it, because she's in the portal, so she's exploring her options. And I think what we have to acknowledge here is, without taking a slight to any league, it's not the same going to the W that it is to the NBA, because it simply doesn't start the contract countdown the same way. So if you are Cooper Flagg and you're a Duke and you're turning around, you're saying, well, if I come back to Duke, sure, I'm going to make millions of dollars in NIL and ad placement, but I'm delaying the start of my real contract money time, you know, for the NBA. We can look at Zion, who's made, what, over $100 million in his career for what, right? So if you're in that spectrum, it's far different than where the financials lie for the WNBA. So now, if you look at it, like, I've seen that she was projected by some to go second overall in the WNBA draft. I guess my question is, where does she have more platform as it exists right now? Is she more marketable to grow sort of her bank account, her brand, everything else at, let's say, Notre Dame or in Seattle playing in the W? And the answer to that is clearly Notre Dame. Like, there is still a draw and a power to what we pay attention to in women's college basketball. So I think this is sort of a statement to where financials are now for the women's game. It's a statement to where financials aren't yet for the WNBA. That's just fact. It's a statement for how much money can be made. We're all seeing these Gatorade ads over and over and over. If you become one of the true faces of women's college basketball, you are going to start making ad money day one. It's tougher to do that in the WNBA. So I think there's a lot of reasons outside of basketball that play to why Olivia could make a decision like this. And then most importantly, I think it's kind of a beautiful thing. Like, if she doesn't feel like she wants to go to the W yet because she's enjoying playing or has something left to prove, like, I love an athlete making this decision, not based on what the financials for their family looks like for the rest of time, but based solely on what they want, what helps them develop the most. So I think it's a win for college basketball. I don't think it has to be a loss for the WNBA. Like, I think all of these statements can be fact without being a negative factor the way the league is built and how the league markets itself. It's just, it feels like she's in a really sweet spot to go back, earn some money, maybe improve her game, maybe improve her brand, maybe improve her status, which will then change her WNBA trajectory.
And I think that's an important distinction, because people might be listening and saying, well, the original NIL happened in professional sports. It's not like NIL and brand deals go away whenever you go pro. But the distinction there is, what is your value and what is your marketability? Because if you are the third or fourth leading scorer on a below average WNBA team, I would argue that your marketability is not nearly as strong as it is as the leading scorer wherever Olivia Miles may decide to go, or as a star at Notre Dame. So I think that's a positive thing for women's college basketball, is we're getting stars that stick around longer because there is a financial incentive to do so. So that means that we can build up these rivalries and that fans can build, you know, a fandom and appreciation for some of these players. With Olivia Miles, though, I do wonder, what is her market like in the transfer portal, Ice? Where do you think would be, you know, a plausible landing spot? Because if I'm Olivia Miles, I look at Haley Van Lith and kind of the career resurrection that she had at TCU. Sports are a copycat league after all. Olivia Miles might be looking around at Anissa Morrow, transferred into LSU, Sudona Prince, who transferred to TCU. All of these players across women's college basketball that have had career resurrections because of transferring. But what would be a plausible landing spot early on, assuming Olivia Miles does, in fact, decide to transfer?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, I mean, now with the parity in women's basketball, there are 10 programs that you could say could fit her, right? She's a 6-foot point guard that, you know, constantly is throwing out dimes, has great court vision, can also score the basketball, and, you know, she wants to play at the next level, which means she's a player that's coming in trying to get better. I feel like an LSU-type team could be fun. I feel like South Carolina is going to graduate a couple of guards. Oh, man, would she be fantastic under Dawn Staley? You know, UCLA, like, I feel like what we've seen from them in terms of, they have Lauren Betts, but if you add another premier guard you know, are you really locking in a national championship? The cool thing about Olivia Miles, I think, is that for those who watch her game, you know, she's adaptable. And so I feel like there wouldn't be a coach that would say, like, Asha's not going to be able to fit into our system. Quite the opposite. I think she can fit into anybody's system and then implement it and make it better. The last thing that we didn't really talk about, maybe a reason she's coming back, y'all, is just to win, right? Like, you know, you're at Notre Dame, 3 straight Sweet 16. She was hurt for one of those. Like, maybe it's simply just to win and get to a national championship and know that you can do that. So I also think from that standpoint, it's attractive if she chooses one of these, you know, powerhouses of teams. I don't think she's going to UConn, but, you know, who am I? Maybe she could surprise us.
There's also an element, guys, like, the advantage the NFL has always had is that college football makes stars. And then when they come into the NFL, there's already name recognition. I would argue right now, women's college basketball is what's making stars. Like, we focus on Angel and Caitlin so much because of what they came to the WNBA with. And that's why we see better advertising opportunities, better everything for them. So there is this element of sticking around, getting the opportunity to win, and really getting another year to amplify your stardom. And I looked it up real quick just for everyone to know the difference. The first overall pick in the 2024 NBA draft projected to earn $12.6 million in his first year, okay? The top four picks in the WNBA will earn a base salary of $76,000. So when you talk about for Olivia Miles, yeah. When you talk about Olivia Miles here and what the decision she's making, it's, do I forego $76,000 if I'm one of the top four picks to win and to play somewhere where I could be the best of myself, to get another year of college where I could just be in college, have a good time, and also build my brand? Like, all of this speaks to the advantages. And, you know, Ice, you pointed out Connecticut. These are the moments that are beautiful for women's college basketball. All of these power programs can look around and say, okay, let's start calling donors, because if that's the piece that we need to continue to win, we will go acquire said piece. Like, I think it's a win for everybody.
I do feel like there is a negative connotation to any player, college or pro, that decides to go somewhere else for either to win a championship or for money. And I just want to say this right here. I have zero problem with a player leaving for either of those motivations, whether it's a combination of the two or one or the other. If Olivia Miles wants to go make money, more money elsewhere, great. Good for you. Get your bag. If you want to leave because you feel like you have a higher likelihood of winning a ring at LSU, South Carolina, Texas, UConn, so on and so forth, good for you. Do it. That's totally 100% your prerogative. And honestly, I don't have any issue with that whatsoever.
And what if you just, like, there's the other side of this, y'all, like, once you get out of college, you suddenly realize, I tell kids all the time, like, you get out of college, you're like, wait a minute, if I don't like my boss, I can't just change classes. If I don't like my job, I can't just transfer. I don't suddenly get summer break, winter break. Like everything's so different. Like, once you grow up one day and you wake up, you're in the real world, like, you're chasing the bag, everything you do in your life. Like, if you could delay that for a year and stay in college, hell, if I could go, like, total old school, I'm going to go Will Ferrell, just go back to college and party for 3 or 4 years right now in life, hell yes, I would do that. So even if you just want to stay in college because it's fun, like, good on you. If you're one of the best basketball players in the world and you can extend your college basketball experience just because you want to party on frat row, I'm not going to sit here and judge you for it. Like, go do your thing.
Not getting 3 months off in the summertime. Brutal.
Yeah.
It's a horrific realization.
We've allowed coaches for years to leave whenever they wanted because they wanted to. As a player, you now have the right to do that. Go ahead and do it. You know, that's my thoughts.
I know we got to move on, but when you say that, all I think about is why do we sit here? Like, Gino is a great example. Like, we don't sit here now and say, oh, for Gino to be a successful coach, he needs to go to the W, or he needs to go to men's basketball. Like, if he's really a great coach, like, we don't do that with the great coaches in women's college basketball. Like, if they choose to stay around the game they love, we look at him like, of course Gino's staying around women's college basketball. He's a legend. Well, like, of course she's staying in women's college basketball because she chooses to. You're totally right.
Yeah, I 100% agree. We'll get back into the women's side of things, but first I want to look back on the men's Elite Eight. I feel like every year we pick up little cookie crumbs, things that we learn, things that we feel like are, you know, major forces in potentially winning a national championship, or just takeaways as a whole. Fitz, I'll start with you. One of your takeaways, something that stood out to you, something that you learned, all of the above from the men's Elite Eight.
I think as much as we've been talking about the SEC and the number of teams they got, what we need to acknowledge is that for some of these big teams, like for Florida and Auburn that play big at the rim, man, that mattered. Like, I just keep thinking about watching small guards that did not know what to do when they just couldn't get to the rim. Like, all of a sudden, when you had to shoot your way out of this to try and loosen up the defense you were taking on, there was nothing there. And then all of a sudden, you can't force it underneath. Like, we watched Big Ten teams, and all, you know, Michigan State team, we've talked a lot about Michigan the same way. Like, we watched Big Ten teams suddenly wake up and feel cautious from the outset. And, you know, I think that speaks to something on the way that these teams are built, Ice. Like, when you have a couple of monster human beings that can stay close enough to the rim to protect it, and now all of a sudden small guards don't feel comfortable driving in, we've just seen that there aren't a lot of teams in the country that can figure out a second way to attack size.
Yeah. When you're closing down space so quickly, and, you know, it seems like you've got six players on the court at one time versus the other team's five, it's just hard to play against. And I think what we're seeing from the SEC teams, yes, that are in the Final Four in Auburn and Florida, but even in the Elite Eight, was just like their style, size, athleticism made the game seem so much smaller than other teams had played against, you know, different opponents because of their lack of size. One of my takeaways was just like, bro, number ones are number one for a reason. Like, they're number one for a reason. On the men's side, Texas Tech fumbled the biggest bag possible.
Oh,
you know, I thought about killer. That. They reminded me of my ex-boyfriend. Like, how dumb. You fumbled the bag. How dumb. Like, crazy. I mean, have Florida on the ropes, guys. Have Florida on the ropes. I'm watching the game and I'm like, oh, they should win this. Like, 3-4 minutes, they should be fine. And then number one's a number one for a reason. Florida figures it out. Walter Clay Jr. just starts being Walter Clay Jr. all of a sudden. Yeah. My favorite play of the tournament, I think so far, besides Derek Queen's, you know, buzzer beater for Maryland, was Walter Clay Jr. just dribbling the ball back to the three-point line, turning and shooting. Like, as fast as he possibly could, just turning and shooting. Like, I'm just going to get this up because I know I can, and I'm feeling it, and I'm in the zone. And then on the women's side, like, we had South Carolina in the Elite Eight, down 1 point with 3 minutes to go in the game to Maryland. And you felt like it's a Maryland team coached by Brandon Freeze, who's gotten to Elite Eights before. And you're kind of like, oh, man, I don't know if they're – I don't know if South Carolina has it. And then 2 minutes later, they're up by 6 points. And you're like, I just number ones are number ones for a reason. They know how to win this time of year. They figured it out. I didn't think either team was going to figure it out, to be quite honest. I was like, oh, like, we got upsets. How fun. And then 2 minutes later, I'm like, oh, nope. Let me shut up.
I mean, Ice, can't we double down at this point and say, like, everybody's quick to tell you when the tournament right brackets come out how terrible the committee is. I think the way this bracket played out speaks to the fact that this year's committee did a spectacular job. The teams were appropriately ranked all over the place. Like, for all of the conversation of who belonged in and who didn't belong in, what do we see? Like, the ones and twos were better than everybody. The threes felt like they were appropriately seated as threes. Like, it's just, I keep watching this thinking, now the committee hit a home, both committees hit home runs in the way that they seated this thing, because the tournament worked out exactly the way it should. And here I sat saying, well, my God, Florida's going to have to get through UConn, then a tough Maryland team, and then they had to get through Florida has only stood up to every challenge that the committee gave them and been like, nah, we're good. We got this. So, like, I think statements have been made by the number one overall seeds. And also, you know, the committee might want to come out, pour one out, and tell everybody that we owe them a big old apology. I'm glad I'm not on the committee, because I would come out and tell the entire basketball world to kiss my ass based on what you had to say a month ago versus based on where we sit right now.
Which is fair. And it also, that thought process, because I 100% agree, made me laugh whenever I heard Nate Oates, after losing to Duke, honestly getting their butts whooped by Duke, Nate Oates said, well, you know, our path would have been easier had we been a one seed. And he said it in more or less words. Like, I don't think that was a direct quote, but essentially his thought was, our path would have been easier if we were a one seed. That's why we need to work harder in the regular season to earn a one seed. And I thought, Nate, brother, like, I don't think that you got beat because you were a two. I think you got beat because you ran into a buzzsaw that is Cooper Flagg and Duke, and they played a completely different level of defense than we've seen from them throughout the entirety of the tournament. So no, I don't think it's the fact that you had a two next to your name. I think you just played a team that was better than you, and very rightfully so, deserved to be a one seed. So yeah, seeding 100% correct.
How stinking good. Like, think about Duke. Think about Houston. I mean, what somebody tell me the fatal flaw of Houston.
Houston, you're right, Vic. Let's talk about it. Where are the flaws? Where are the flaws? I don't know.
They don't exist.
Someone asked me to power rank the four teams on the men's side in the final four. And my brain literally short fused. I was like, I don't know. I don't know. I guess after I watched Duke Alabama, I was like, Duke's the best team in this tournament. And then I watched Houston hold Tennessee to 15 first half points. And I was like, wait, maybe Houston's the best team. And then watching Florida and their entire run throughout the tournament, close call against Texas Tech, but finding a way to win. Like, I think that there is very, very strong and fair arguments for all four of these teams to be the best team in the field.
Houston plays the most complimentary basketball of anybody, though, to me. Like, they are going to make it ugly, and they are prepared to make it ugly. Like, Duke, Florida can beat you however you want to take them on. Houston's not going to give you that option. They're going to put the game in a vice grip. They're going to slow it down, and they're going to make you earn every day. We talked about size. I mean, their closing speed. It's just ice. Everything that they do on defense makes you uncomfortable, and so they make a game so ugly that it's like, man, Houston won that, and I don't even know how to feel about it because they pummel their opponents the way they make them play, and they bring out the worst in everybody they play.
Yeah, I mean, they're the equivalent to me of South Carolina on the women's side. Like, it doesn't matter whether the game is pretty or ugly. Stylistically, they will figure it out. It will fit them. And to be quite honest, in the tournament, you want to make it ugly. You don't want anybody to be in rhythm. You don't want anybody to be comfortable. You want teams to feel like they're getting a root canal when they have to see you on their bracket. And so I feel like that's what Houston is. Like, it's a big old root canal. I don't want to go near it. This is going to be long. This is going to be exhausting. I'm going to be tired at the end of it. Who wants to go through that? I can't wait for their matchup with Duke. Like, this is how I had this side of the bracket going, with Houston and Duke getting to the Final Four. And I had Houston advancing because I feel like with their defense and their versatility and their depth, it'll be hard for Duke to handle. And this is a Duke team that literally every time they play, they look better. I mean, these guys, you could tell it's a young group because every time they get on the floor, they're piecing it together more and more and more. It's like, oh my goodness, the job that John Shire has done with these young men, fantastic. But yeah, I mean, the way Houston beat Tennessee, I didn't see coming. And it's so funny when you get a 19-point blowout to get to the Final Four, you're like, oh, okay. We kind of got a little ski mask day. We could just get through this one and then, you know, relax or whatever. So interesting.
Plenty of people were talking their talk about how can you have an NCAA tournament team score 13 points in the first half? You know, and that happened on the women's bracket. It was an ugly look. I was blowing everybody up. I'm like, where are we now on Tennessee 15? Like, we are literally talking about the worst first half ever by a top two seeded team in college basketball. Like, not the worst lately, the worst statistical points ever in the first half by a top two seed. Like, that's stunning by Houston. It's not stunning that they beat Tennessee. It is stunning that they made Tennessee look like a junior varsity basketball team.
And this is an experienced Tennessee team with an experienced coach.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't just a bunch of freshmen in a Cinderella that happened to luck out into getting into the Elite Eight. That was a very good Tennessee team that was just barely keeping open this window that they currently have with Jemai Meshack and Zakai Ziegler, and who knows what Rick Barnes' future looks like. But I think that's one of my takeaways, one lesson that I maybe learned from the men's Elite Eight and now the field that we have in the Final Four. Sports are so copycat, and that's one of the, like, first things that I learned whenever I got into this business and observing teams year over year and season over season and leagues year over year. Whatever one team does, Everyone else wants to recreate that. A young coach has success. Everyone wants to hire him. Dan Hurley wins back-to-back national championships. Now, all of a sudden, he's interviewing to be the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. You know, the St. Louis Rams. The Los Angeles Rams sold the farm to get Matthew Stafford and won a Super Bowl. Now, all of a sudden, Deshaun Watson and Russell Wilson become the hottest free agents on the market because everybody wants an experienced quarterback. Sports are copycat. I don't see, though, with the four coaches that we have represented in the Final Four on the men's side, I don't see that. Half of the field between Bruce Pearl and Kelvin Sampson, they're established. They've been around. They've been coaching for 30-plus years. They know what this is like. They are experienced, well-seasoned coaches. And then you have John Shire and Todd Golden on the other side, younger than 40. Their first big-time jobs. This is the largest stage that they've ever been on as head coaches. So if there's a team out there that has a job opening, thinks a coach is on the way out, feels like there's something better on the other side and a young gun or wants a more established coach, I think that what we've seen from the Final Four is there is no really path to copycat, at least from the coaches that we see represented, because this Final Four shows whether you are inexperienced and young or whether you have all of the experience in the world, you can be at the top of the sport.
I think, though, to your point, if you look at the top eight teams in the country this year, you had eight coaches that are among the elite in college basketball. They're among the best, and eight coaches that truly understood exactly who they were. Like, you're not talking about guys that are coming in and trying the recipes for what's hot. They run a classic steakhouse and they're good running a classic steakhouse. They're not trying to do Asian fusion suddenly. So I think there is something to finding a coach that's so rooted in the fundamentals of who they are and how they do things that they remain consistent even when everything around them swirls around. And that is one thing that I think really stands out to me. Like, yes, John Shire's a young coach, but what did John Shire do? I mean, he basically brought everything that he knew about Duke basketball to Duke basketball again, right? So very consistent in who he is. And, you know, I think you could say the same thing with Bruce Pearl is very, because like, even when you were listening to, you know, everybody get ready for that Bruce Pearl, Tom Izzo matchup, you're just sitting there listening to two legendary coaches talk about how great the other coach is. And they're both right. You know, these are great coaches that are very secure in who they are and the programs they run. And I think that's the one thing that it's impossible to get to, a coach that's not trying to swim up to the next level anymore. And a coach that's just like, this is where I am, this is what I do, and this is how we do it. And when you find that person, man, that gives you the stability that we all crave in college basketball.
And to that point too, Todd Golden, kind of under the tutelage of Bruce Pearl, he's brought so much of what he learned from Bruce Pearl at Auburn to Florida, kind of runs his program that way. Fitz, what did you learn from the women's side?
Ooh. Okay, first and foremost, I'm mad at Notre Dame. I just want to say that loud. On the Yahoo Fantasy bracket competition, I was in fourth for the whole competition on the women's bracket.
Okay, flex.
Until the Notre Dame loss, which dropped me to 30th. I'm very mad about that because I had Notre Dame going to the Final Four. I'm mad at Notre Dame. I learned that. But then, more importantly, when we submitted our picks for everything, I submitted my pick that I believed UConn would win the championship. And when I was asked who the most outstanding player was, said Paige. And I think that this is just that redemption moment. I thought coming into this tournament, we would see a different energy from Paige Beckers because it feels like she's been forgotten. It feels like we don't appreciate it as much. And then what have you seen? I mean, the number of times, and it's not just the stat line on it. I mean, 40 points, career high, that's impressive. It's the fact that when these games just need a moment, a momentum push, something, it's Paige that every single time seems to stroke a brilliant three out of nowhere with somebody in her face. And it's the shooting when it matters most that separates. Like, this UConn team has been separating itself with these quick burst runs where it's close game, then it's not. And then it tightens a little bit and it's not. And Paige is the juice behind that. So as much as we talked about Sarah Strong and AZ Fudd and why they deserve a ton of credit, I thought Paige was going to be the most outstanding player of this tournament. I think Paige is the most outstanding player in this tournament. And I feel better than ever that Paige and UConn are going to win this championship because they are playing on a different level.
I think that kind of goes along with what I learned. And it's that every team needs its Robin, but also every team needs its Batman too. And you can't have one without the other. I mean, we see that with Rory Harmon and Madison Booker. I mean, against TCU, Madison Booker was silent in the first half. It was Rory Harmon that carried a majority of the offensive load. In the second half, when TCU was wearing them down a little bit and they were getting it closer, then Madison Booker did Madison Booker things. We see the same thing with Paige Beckers and Sarah Strong and AZ Fudd. Really, Sarah Strong in the tournament has been outstanding, which is even more impressive considering this is her very first tournament ever. You look at UCLA, you need Lauren Betts and you also need Kiki Rice. You look at South Carolina. I mean, they got a whole team full of Batman because they've had a different leading scorer in every single tournament game so far. So those supplementary scores are so key. But then you look at USC. Maybe that USC-UConn game goes differently if Juju Watkins is on the floor. Maybe it doesn't. Like, maybe UConn still wins. Maybe Paige Beckers is still fantastic and puts up 30-plus. But maybe USC wins that game if they have Juju Watkins. And I know that that's a hypothetical that is just going to drive that entire USC fan base and team crazy. And I hate that we now are kind of living in that world of uncertainty. But USC very clearly missed Juju Watkins in a matchup like that. They were able to beat Mississippi State and Kansas State without her with their supplementary scores. But when they came up against a true national champion contender, they missed that Batman. You need both.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think what I learned is supplementary scores, yes, but just you need X factors in the tournament. You need players that maybe you haven't expected them to play this way. Maybe they have showed glimpses of this throughout the season. But when it's all said and done in tournament time, they're the X factor. I think of Texas women's basketball, who's now going to a Final Four for the first time since 2003. And I'm in Birmingham literally right now. I've been doing their last two games for Westwood One, and their game to get to the Elite Eight, it was two freshmen off the bench that scored in double figures, Jordan Lee and Brianna Preston, that made the difference for them. Their game last night to get to the Final Four, it's Kyla Oldacre, their backup big that came into the game, gave Sedona Prince a tough time. She only scored 4 points, didn't get in double figures, did not double figure numbers in rebounding, and it's an X factor big. And I'm talking to Vic Schaefer, and I'm like, Coach, like, you know, how do you get it every time where your players off the bench are so ready to make huge impacts in game-to-game situations? And both times, it's because the game called for more guards, that the freshman guard stood up, right? The game called for more bigs, so the big stood up. And he's just like, we stay primed and we stay ready. I even think about USC. Like, I don't know if you would have told me if Juju got hurt, that they would win two games in the tournament without her. I wouldn't have banked on that. I 100% probably would have banked on a blanket upset. But Avery Howe, like Kennedy Smith, those two freshmen combined and had double figures to get them to the Elite Eight game. So to me, it's all about the X factors this time of year. Yes, like I Fitz, you talking about Paige, and I'm just like, I like proud of Paige, you know, because she's like our basketball child that we've all grown up and see and blossoms. But this is it right now. Like the best basketball that Paige can play in her career is going to happen right now. We're going to see it right now because we know that the next level is going to get tumbly hard. And then she's going to be a rookie again and she's going to have to figure it out. But I think the X factors for me, at least on the women's side, have been the difference. And the stars are going off cool, but who's coming off the bench and really making a difference? Who's coming off the bench and really doing something that's going to shock the world? And I just love players that are ready when their names are called.
And that's, I think, what makes UConn feel like the Cinderella in a world where we don't have a Cinderella. And it's crazy to call UConn a Cinderella when they've won 11 national championships and they've been to 16 of the last 17 Final Fours and they have the best player in the sport. But Paige's story that we've all followed, that we've all fell in love with, this run feels very Cinderella-esque, doing it for her. So yeah, I totally agree there. Coming up next, we'll look ahead to the Final Four. Look, I'm dramatic and I'm incredibly hyperbolic, but I don't think I'm being hyperbolic in saying that we're getting the best ever. And we'll explain why coming up next. So we've talked a lot about how we have 4-1 seeds in the Final Four. I love it. I think it's great, and I think it's refreshing that we get the four best teams in the sport competing for a national championship. But just to add context to just how good this Final Four is. Matt Norlander of CBS put this tweet out, and it is the top 10 teams in KenPom of all time. Duke this season is number 2. Houston this season is 6. Florida is 8. Auburn is 10. That's not KenPom rankings this year. That is KenPom rankings of all time, going back to the 1996-97 season. So over the last 28 years, we have KenPom ratings and data and numbers that have all been crunched. We have 4 of the top 10 teams in KenPom all time competing for a national championship here. I almost feel like it's unfair to these teams that 3 of them are going to fall short of a national championship. But from our perspective, from a fan's perspective, from people who get to talk about the sport for a living like we do, Fitz, I feel so lucky that we may just witness the greatest Final Four in the history of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and I think this is where, look, some historian's going to come in and be like, well, actually, in the 1963, okay, fine.
There's a statute of limitations on these things.
You know, I look at all of it and say, like, okay, what shelf? If I was going into a bar and I'm like, give me top shelf liquor. This is a top shelf Final Four. Like, if it's not the best, it's one of the best. And I think part of that comes from, as we talked about earlier, you have great coaches, you have superstar players, and so often we want to define these Final Fours by what ends up happening with these players at the next level. You know, they love to put together montages to show you where guys are in the NBA. I don't care about any of that. Like, what I care about right now is this is a Duke team that has a couple of stars on it that look unstoppable with the coach that is absolutely putting his team in the best position to win. This is a Houston team. We've already credited a bunch on this show. This is a Florida team that not only ran through the SEC tournament, but has remained hot through a gauntlet of a bracket that just looks impossible. And an Auburn team that a lot of us were ready to give up on at the end of the regular season that suddenly just has, they have brought all of it back together. And I look at all of it, and we asked earlier what the fatal flaw for Houston is. I think that you could pretty confidently, if you were a fan of each of these teams, you could say, I don't see a fatal flaw for my favorite team either. Like, that's why this is so interesting. I don't think this is going to be about who loses themselves a championship. This is going to be about who actually has the hot day, who executes the best, who gets a little lucky, because there's such a fine line between these teams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the best thing is that across the board, there's no talent discrepancy with either of these teams. Everybody's equally talented. Everybody's got depth. Everybody has size. Everybody has ran through their conference and has been battle tested. We talked about Florida and Auburn all year because of the SEC. We chatted about how Houston ran through the Big 12 and had a good challenge. And then obviously we know what Duke has been able to do. To me too, the coolest aspect of this is seeing that a coach will get his first time national championship. Like, how cool is it that none of these coaches have won a national championship? Like, we all here for the first time. You know, we're all trying to do this thing for the first time. And I think it makes it for, like, an interesting story. We knew that at some point we were going to see an SEC matchup again, probably in the Elite Eight or in the Final Four. I love that it ended up with Florida and Auburn. I just think it's going to make for more interesting storylines. And when you face a familiar foe again this late in the season, how cool is that going to be? And then just tons of storylines for Houston and Duke. I love that it's all number ones, not because the committee was right, but because the number ones took care of business. They came into the tournament and were like, we're number one. We worked this hard for this seeding. Now let's show people why we are number one. And I just expect it to be great basketball. I'm with you. Like, I think these games are going to be close. I think they're going to be down to the wire. I think at the end of the day, somebody will probably get outcoached, which is also exciting to watch. I don't know about you, but I love to see when a coach gets outcoached and they got to figure it out. And it's like, yeah, you just had in the wrong player at that time. You're going to take this L. But these games are going to be good. And I'm just excited to see a coach for the first time get a national championship.
I kind of love giving two Final Four coaches days to prepare for an opponent that they've seen a couple of times. Like, that is such a, like, the line on, am I going to overthink it? Am I just going to do what works? Wait, are they're going to be ready for that? Do I do something else? Like the line for a coach on we just do what we do versus we're going to stop what they do gets so difficult when you're talking about seeing a team again. And so I think that it's an incredible opportunity to see two guys just go in the lab with their teams on a familiar opponent. For anyone that hates that because we're seeing common opponent again, I love the fact that it lets you elevate.
I don't need to see a matchup again if the first time or times we saw it wasn't that great. Sign me up for another Auburn and Florida matchup. When Florida got the best of Auburn in their own house, like give me that again. Give me Bruce Pearl versus Todd Golden, kind of the master and the sensei, the teacher and the student. I talked to Todd Golden this morning. He said, yeah, I talk to Stephen Pearl like every single day. I talk to Bruce throughout the season, like once every couple of weeks. Like we are tight. We are friends. And he says he carries so much of what he learned from Bruce Pearl into his coaching style. So that kind of dynamic there. And I asked him, I was like, does that make it almost easier because you're familiar with them? Does it make it more awkward because you're so familiar with them? And he's like, yeah, it's a mixture of both. Like, I know Bruce, I know his coaching style, I know what he wants to do, I know what he doesn't want to do. But also, it's like having that kind of familiarity maybe leads you to overthink things. So I love that we're seeing that. We're also seeing it in the women's side as well. We get South Carolina, Texas for a fourth time. Fourth time this season.
Unbelievable.
I mean, we get Dawn Staley and Vic Schaefer again in the Final Four.
Are we at all concerned that South Carolina has struggled at times in this tournament? Like that you get credit for winning close games, but we got a couple of them in a row that have been like, man, it's coming down to the wire. Like I'm starting to get a little nervous about South Carolina.
Yo, my mom literally texts me probably in every fourth quarter of a South Carolina game. And I'm from South Jersey, you know, so Dawn Staley, like, is from Philly, coached in Philly. So, like, we've always kind of just rooted for her. And I swear to you, my mom texts me every fourth quarter of this tournament, besides, like, the first two games, it was like, they're making me nervous. Like, they're making me nervous. Yeah, seriously. One, you know, they had some tough draws. Like, seeing Indiana to get to a Sweet 16, not a fun game. Two, I think Brenda Fries and Maryland put together a very good game plan against them to make it a close game. You know, the other thing about South Carolina is, you know, Dawn Staley is old school. She plays old school basketball. They don't shoot a ton of threes, even though they're one of the best 3-point shooting teams in the country. They still throw the ball in the paint a ton. And so sometimes you're looking and you're like, these games are close because they haven't scored almost like as they should. You know, they're not knocking down 10 threes a game and like shooting at a high clip. They're just kind of beating you in an old school way. I don't think there's a need to be hesitant or cautious or nervous about South Carolina in the Final Four. First of all, they're 21-1 in the last NCAA. Ridiculous. Like, ridiculous.
That's insane.
Yeah, ridiculous. Players like Malaysia Fuwaili and Tessa Thompson only know how to win this time of year. They were undefeated last year. So I think teams around them are getting better and they're scouting them better and they're giving them better challenges and game plans. But I just think too, like, number one's a number one for a reason. They figure out how to win. They figure out how to grind it out. And, you know, as I look at the women's side, South Carolina and Texas, UCLA and UConn, I just can't help but think that we're going to get a UConn and South Carolina final and championship. And I don't know. You talked about Dawn Staley and Vic Schaefer. I don't know what's a better matchup than Dawn Staley and Gina Auriemma. You know, that is just like the premier coaches that you want to see. You know the teams have the talent. You know now the history behind the program so that they have an expectation to win a Final Four. And then, too, let me give some credit to UCLA because Caroline has asked me several times since we started March Madness, like, what's going to be the first number one seed to drop? And every time I said UCLA with full confidence. No disrespect to UCLA because I'm really happy for them, but the first time ever that they're in a Final Four. I mean, the way that Lauren Betts and Chloe Close has guided this team has been fun, but it's also cool when you get a team in the Final Four that's doing something for the first time. Like, it just means a little bit more, and the storylines are just so much better because you know they're creating history. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I just love talking about basketball. Like, y'all really don't know how happy I am.
By the way,
my
like,
eyes
not
are
for
bleeding,
nothing.
But my heart's happy.
We've had some conversations even on this show about, you know, is UCLA it? Is UCLA not it? They really haven't even been that tested in the tournament compared to everybody else. Like, they've kind of made it look a little easy. I'm just saying, like I said earlier, there's been moments in the UConn games where you're like, man, I don't know. UConn's going to have to turn it on at some point. South Carolina has had some close finishes in this bad boy. And UCLA's over here just like, doing the damn thing, and we're all just sort of sitting back saying, well, I mean, it's UCLA. Let's see. I mean, I picked UConn, South Carolina before this whole thing turned out as my championship game. So I'm not changing that pick, but still, man, I don't know. Like, I do feel like UCLA's over here just saying, keep sleeping, y'all. Like, it's fine. We'll do this. No pressure on us.
I was with ICE all the way. I thought, okay, well, we got Juju in USC. We've got Paige in UConn. We've got Indon Stately Trust in South Carolina. You know, this UCLA team has been playing with fire all season long. They lost to USC twice in the regular season. What they did to LSU when Lauren Betts was in foul trouble. If you'll allow me, please, to put my purple and gold tinted glasses on as an alumni of LSU. When Lauren Betts was sitting on the bench in foul trouble, I thought, hell freaking yes. This is the opportunity. You know, their big is gone. Their leading scorer is on the bench. Like, this is your opportunity to step up, get a comfortable lead going into halftime. And then when Lauren Betts comes back out, hopefully you build upon that lead even more and you can just kind of give yourself some wiggle room. That's not what happened. It was Gabriella Jaquez and it was Kiki Rice and it was the rest of this team that stepped up and got the lead at halftime. And then when Lauren Betts came back in, it was just kind of game over from there. I feel like I saw a different level of UCLA when they were Lauren Betts-less that now gives me this like newfound confidence. All of that being said, I'm still picking them to lose to UConn. I picked UConn South Carolina in the national championship game. I still feel confident in that pick. But to give credit to UCLA, I feel like they've done more with less than I expected in the tournament, Fitz.
Can I also, since you mentioned LSU, and since I like pulling my soapbox up about the way coaches act in front of a microphone, I got it. Like Kim Mulkey going off at a reporter for asking about being eliminated in the Elite Eight to me was such a soft move by a coach. And I would say this is just a reminder to everybody that says, well, how many have you played in? Okay, number one, I will always say, if that's the logic we're going to take as a society, that you can only cover things that you're great at, then I never want to hear anybody's movie review that doesn't have an Oscar. I never want to hear anybody's music review unless you got a bunch of these behind you. You don't get to talk about it at all unless you have those sorts of awards. That's not the world we live in with any other industry, and that's not the world we live in sports. When a journalist asks the appropriate question about the result for LSU and the coach comes back and claps back at the journalist, my only response is, the journalist has done their job by asking the question. Have you done your job, coach, by getting eliminated in the Elite Eight for two consecutive years? The answer to that is no. That's not what you're paid to do. Journalist was doing what the journalist was paid to do. You're paid to sit at the podium and humbly answer questions after your team gets tossed from said tournament. It's just the number of times that we let certain coaches in this business get away with whatever they want, however they want, because it makes them a boss. It doesn't make you a boss. It makes you look small. It makes you look like little things bother you that shouldn't. And if your players attacked with the same level of aggressiveness in their answer to people doing their jobs, you would certainly ride them. So, Kim Mulkey, shame on you. Not for losing the Elite Eight. Shame on you for yet again handling a press conference like you are better than everybody else there.
I wanted to give her a Hurley Award.
Yeah.
I wish
give her
I,
a Hurley.
Yeah, I was like, where's our Hurley Award?
She gets a Hurley.
We gotta give it to her. Yeah, she gets a Hurley.
We're coining that on this show. We're giving you the Hurley. When you're a coach that's just unnecessarily a jerk, you get a Hurley.
Speaking of a Hurley, I saw a clip. I haven't watched the entire thing of an ESPN original out about Dan Hurley. There was just some clips put out on Instagram. And there was one clip where he said, what's the worst thing you could say about me? I'm too passionate. Maybe I cross the line a couple of times a season. Like, Yeah, Dan Hurley, that is what we can say about you. Like, and that's not a good thing. Like, don't gaslight us into thinking like, oh, I care too much. Like, you sound like your toxic boyfriend. That's like, you called me 64 times when I was at dinner with my friends. And he's like, oh, I care too much. It's like, no, you're crazy. You're stalking me. Like, yes, Dan Hurley, that is the worst thing we could say about you. And it's not a good thing.
Yeah, no, apparently acting like a petulant child when you're the highest paid educator for the state is acceptable. And again, at the end of the day, it's a college paying you to go out there and be an educator, whether we like that answer or not. Like, that is, you are educating everybody that plays for you, that's the normal acceptable method of behavior. So Hurley, no, the worst we can say is that, you know, you're an egomaniac that treats people like you're better than they are and that constantly looks at the world like it's your oyster and everybody else is just riding in your roller coaster. That is not necessarily the way most people should behave that are professionals.
Yeah, the issue is that we continue to give, you know, some of these coaches a pass for when they act like this. We just say, oh, it's just early. Oh, it's just Kim. Oh, it's just whatever. Like, no, these are also just people.
Yeah, and if Angel Reese looked at an official and said, don't turn your back on me, I'm the best player in the world, we would destroy her. If Caitlin Clark said, don't turn your back on me, I'm the best player in the world, it would turn into, how do we accept this behavior? If Cooper Flagg, if Christian Laettner back in the day had been like, don't turn your back on me, I'm the best player in the world. Oh,
LeBron?
My God. LeBron's a perfect example of that.
God forbid. Oh, that would be a crazy day on First Take.
Yeah.
Scary.
If LeBron missed
Twitter.
The game-winning shot and a journalist asked him about it and he turned around and said, how many game-winning shots have you made? So I guess we're doing pretty good, better than you are. We would absolutely, like, the headline the next day would be, LeBron is a crybaby. He can't handle basic criticism. What are we doing? And like, but then when it's Kim Mulkey, it's like, oh no, this is cool. Like, that's just Kim being Kim. Like, no, it's not. If you're being you're being a dick.
We also don't make $6 million a year.
Yeah.
Right. But also take it a step further, like, the women's game has grown so much over the last couple of years. 4 years ago, guys, we were begging people to come to the tournament. We were begging people to cover us at the bottom. We were begging reporters to drive 2 hours and actually show up and cover. So now we get people in the room. It's packed in these media rooms. I'm in Birmingham. There's tons of people around. And now we get people in the building. And you treat them like that? That's the problem. The problem is, like, you also are responsible for the game. You're responsible for growing the game. You asking the reporter how many Final Fours he's been to, or his stating a fact that you've lost to just in the last 2 years in the Elite Eight. And I think last thing I'll say about this, it made me laugh because it was like, he said it. It's like, yo, second year in a row that you guys have gotten stumped at the Elite Eight. You know, bro, the Elite Eight, that is a compliment. That is a congratulations. We're not taking a dig at you, baby girl. Your team is in the Elite Eight for 2 years in a row. Congratulations. Like, I just also was like, you took it way too personal. But as someone who's been helping to grow the game for the last several years, you can't ask for people to show up and then treat them badly when they do. You can't have it both ways. And it's okay. She's home, so we don't have to talk about her anymore.
Yeah. And look, saying, hey, that's just Kim. Hey, that's Dan Hurley. That's an excuse or an explanation, and not an excuse. It's an explanation of, this is how Kim Mulkey is. That doesn't excuse it at all, but that is what she is. That's who she is. That's how she treats people. She is not going to change anytime soon, whether we like it or you like it or not. That is not an excuse. That is simply, I think I just got an Amazon package. That is simply,
no, I think that's somebody delivering a Hurley.
That's
I love
Kim Mulkey.
I want a trophy.
She's listening.
Kim Mulkey coming in.
She's coming. She's like, bang, bang, open up.
Y'all are too young to remember this.
For you.
It's full Pee Wee's Playhouse where, like, the doorbell used to ring and then he'd go to the door and be like, ha ha. And then he'd open the door and there'd be a surprise guest there. Like, Samuel L. Jackson's about to walk through your door.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. They've tapped my house. They've tapped our microphones. I'm going to get in trouble. So with that, we'll take a quick break. We will give our official predictions coming up on the other side. Official official picks and predictions for the Final Four. We will start with the women because they play first. We've got UCLA and UConn on one side, South Carolina and Texas on the other. Ice, I'll start with you. Your picks for the national championship game and who is our eventual national champion?
Yes. So I believe that South Carolina is going to beat Texas. They beat them twice already this season, but I think they can get them one more time. On the other side, I think UConn is going to beat UCLA. I'm trusting Paige Beckers. I'm trusting Gina Auriemma and Sarah Strong. I think she's going to be the key for that game. I have South Carolina winning in the national championship. Man, this time of year, like you said, Caroline, in Dawn Staley, we trust.
All right. So I've got UConn taking on South Carolina in the championship game. That was my pre-tournament pick. It remains my tournament pick. And then I still maintain we've only seen it once this year. But when these two teams played, it wasn't even close to Ice's point. You know, obviously, I think now you've got an angry Dawn Staley coming in. They're going to use that as firing them up for the whole time. But it's still, I think Paige and that big three for Connecticut's a nightmare for everybody. I think UConn beats South Carolina for the championship. Ooh. And that might propel me to the top of the women's brackets, I'm hoping. At least, top 30 can become top five again. There we go.
I'm going to be different. I'm going to pick UConn and South Carolina in the national championship game. That's who I've had from the jump. And I've had South Carolina winning from the jump, and I'm sticking with the Gamecocks. I said this on our Selection Sunday reaction show. Dawn Staley will not let Gina Auriemma get her twice. There is no way. They got blown out in the regular season. And Dawn Staley talks about, she's said before, and I absolutely love this from her, I don't lose very frequently, but when I do, I learn a lesson. And I think that she may have learned her lesson from losing to UConn. She knows how to play them. She knows how to prepare for them, how to mentally get her team ready for a national championship game. They are so deep. And this time of year, you need that depth. You need those fresh legs. South Carolina can beat you in so many different ways. And I love that because I love Dawn Staley and I love the South Carolina program and what she's built. I also hate that at the same time, but it is how it plays out, that Paige Beckers will have 5 years at UConn with no national championship. That just doesn't feel right. So either way, we're going to get an awesome story, whether it's South Carolina or UConn or whether it's UCLA or whether it's Texas, whoever finds themselves in the national championship game, we're going to get great stories. But let's move to the men's side. We've got Auburn and Florida for the second time this season. We've got Duke and Houston. Fitz, who you picking?
These games are so tight that I have to look at tiebreakers in my mind. And tiebreakers, to me, are the player that I trust the most in the biggest moments. And all I keep thinking about with Auburn is Jani Broome's arm dangling. And I respect the heck out of the fact that he came back in. But, man, I don't think any of us can really know what that's going to impact here. And how many times have we seen Clayton just go up and get the shot when he needs the shot the most? So I trust the player that has come up the most clutch in the tournament to do it again. I will take Florida over Auburn as a result. I'd say the same thing on the other side that, frankly, you know, Houston's defense can take so much away. But as much as we talk about Cooper Flagg, I think Konga Nipple is also somebody that deserves a ton of credit for the way he's played in this tournament. They got two guys that are almost impossible to stop. I think that's enough to propel Duke. So we end up with the Duke versus Florida national championship game. And that's where, again, best player on the court, if it all goes even to me, is still going to be Cooper Flagg. That's an inch. I don't know, y'all. I feel like I'm flipping the coin. But my pre-tournament pick was Duke to win the championship. I will stick with Duke beating Florida in the national championship game. But, man, this Florida team's hot. I don't feel good about any of it. I would not put my money on any of this because I think it's too tight to do that. But that's how I get there.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people have a Florida and Duke national championship, and I'm not mad at it at all. It's tough to say that these teams won't get there because of how they performed in the tournament, how they continue to pull out games. I do have Florida beating Auburn. I'm sticking with my stat that no national champion has ever lost three out of the last four regular season games, so I just don't think that Auburn's gonna make that history. And then I'm sticking with who I've had winning this thing the whole time, which has been Houston. I think Houston's defense is going to be something that Duke has had a tough time dealing with. I think they're going to send Cooper Flagg to the NBA. We wish you well, my guy. And then I think they're going to beat Florida. And then I think they're going to beat Florida. I kind of believe in just their style of play, the fact that they can make it ugly and they don't have to win it in a pretty way. They don't have to knock down a bunch of threes or whatever else. They're kind of my fun pick. Also, important factor, the Final Four is in San Antonio. Houston is 3 hours away.
True.
It's going to be advantage.
Like a home game. It's going to be like a home game. I might act like I'm from H-Town. It's going to be like a home game. So I also think that that's pretty cool.
I think the image of Kelvin Sampson winning a national championship could be one of the coolest things in the sports history. Like, it's just such a easy coach to root for, such an easy program to root for. And you're right. Like, we talked about it the very first night when this bracket was released. Like, there was a way that Houston could end up with essentially home court advantage in the Final Four. They got that. They earned it. They've gotten there. We have slept on Houston all year. For Houston to go out and do that, man, that would be – I cannot imagine. Like, last year, the thing that will always be seared in my mind, because, like, we were lucky – I was lucky enough to go to my first Final Four last year. And for anyone that doesn't know, you can't buy tickets to one portion of it. You have to buy the whole weekend. And so what happens is – you know, last year, everybody that wasn't named Connecticut and Purdue, when they got eliminated, they didn't go to the championship game. So the actual championship game itself was like half empty. The vibe was a little low. Like, there weren't a lot of UConn fans there because, like, they weren't sticking. They didn't come down for it. It was a long drive. Like, all of these things factored into getting to Arizona. The thought of having Houston in a championship game in San Antonio, that place will be packed. Like, that is God, I need that. I'm jealous y'all are going to be in Tampa, but if Houston ends up in the championship game, I'm no longer jealous.
Ice is going to be in San Antonio.
Oh, Ice, you're in San Antonio.
She's going to be holding it down with the rest of the Houston fans.
Oh,
I might have a Houston t-shirt on at the end of the day. I might come on here next week. Like, let's go, H-Town.
She's a lifelong Houston fan as of like 5 minutes ago.
Look, Ice and I are going to be dancing on the side of the court.
It's beautiful this time of year. All of that being said, though, with it essentially being a Houston home game, would anybody care to guess what the spread is for that Houston-Duke game?
Duke 5.5?
Duke 5.5. Ding, ding, ding. Great guess. Like a 5.5 point spread.
Y'all, I got a problem. Like, I have not seen it. That was just my rough guess. I have got, like, look, I need to delete the apps. Like, that's what I just, and I'm not talking about the dating apps. I need to delete all of the gambling apps at this point. If I just pull 5.5 off the top of my head, I'm not proud of that.
Whenever you grow up in Vegas, do you have like a mental sports book just ingrained into your DNA?
No, you learn the opposite. Like, my parents are always like, don't gamble, you will lose. Like, they don't build these casinos by accident. Like, they win your money. And damn it, they're right. Like, I got into the tournament and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to put some fun money in here. And it's no longer fun. Like, none of that money is fun. It's all just gone. I should have just given it to charity.
But all of that being, like, a 5.5 point favorite in the Final Four after Houston just held Tennessee to, I believe, their season low, 15 points in the first half, that feels a wee bit disrespectful. I'm going to take Houston to beat Duke pre-tournament. I had Duke and Florida in the national championship game. After I watched what Houston did to Tennessee, I am riding the Cougs. It is Houston to the national championship, but that's where it stops for me. Florida's my national champion.
Yes, Carolina. Yes, Carolina, you are the only 10 iced tea.
Let's go. Let's go. But yeah, I eventually have
everybody
Florida
loves
the
a cougar.
Championship game. Everyone loves a cougar. Who doesn't?
Yeah, that's all I'll say.
Ram. Well, that is going to do it for us today. Like we said, Ice and Fitz will be in San Antonio. I will be in Tampa. So we'll have full coverage to all of the action. We'll have press conference reactions. We'll have game previews, game reactions, all of those live on site. So make sure to keep it right here on Yahoo Sports for all of those. You can follow Fitz at Jason Fitz on Twitter. She is at IceYoung23. You can find me at CarolineFenton1. Always appreciate y'all stopping by the podcast. If you're new here, welcome in. Give us a like, give us a subscribe, give us a review. If you are a repeat listener, always appreciate you. Do the same. Make sure that you subscribe on YouTube and on your preferred podcast platform, and tell all of your friends. Tell Kim Mulkey, because she might still just be waiting at my front door. We'll be back next week to recap the national championship games. We're out.